should just introduce ourselves so the people listening to this know who we are. This is the voice you hear now is Gene Carney, and I'm interviewing Cliff Kachline?
Kachline.
Okay.
Just so you call me.
Okay. And I'll call you Cliff during the interview,
yeah, sure.
If that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Just the brevity of something.
Yep. I'm only 2 years older than you.
I'm 28. Okay. And I'd like to just maybe, go through a little outline, and you can fill in the blanks. And I understand you started your baseball, total baseball outline. That started with one of the days when you were a sports editor at the North Penn Reporter in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. And I gather you probably were about 20 at the time?
Yes.
Probably right out of school?
I believe I was 21 when I started there, yes. I'd had a little earlier newspaper experience.
Okay. Did you play ball when you were a young man?
I was on the high school team for 2 or 3 years, had a uniform, never really played, though. Not that good.
The first job, was that a baseball-related job?
No.
Just a journalist job?
Well, going back, I graduated in 39 from high school, the oldest of 5 children in the family. There was no mention of college, no suggestion really of going to college. And of course, our family didn't have the money, I was sure, to send me to college. So I got a job, a very menial job. My dad wanted me to become an apprentice printer. I applied for that, but a classmate had already applied and gotten a job. A year later, I received a call that the apprentice printer had graduated and they were ready for me to be an apprentice printer. So I took that job and was there, I guess, no more than a month when I wound up in an accident running a big press on a Saturday morning with the head printer and almost lost my right hand. The doctors managed to get that on while I'm in the hospital. I had typhoid fever. They said bye-bye. The doctor said he wouldn't recover, but I did. And because of that injury, I wasn't eligible, of course, for wartime service. When the war broke out, of course, most of the able-bodied young guys were called, and that meant jobs opened up. And people on some of the menial jobs or lower-paying jobs would move up because the position opened. That's what happened to me. I was back working at this daily paper, or weekly paper, in my hometown, Quakertown, Pennsylvania, doing a little advertising, just a little bit of writing, when the fellow who was the correspondent for the Bethlehem Globe-Times, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania,
saw me. I'm from Pittsburgh, so I know Pennsylvania.
That's Bethlehem's at the other end, of course.
Right.
Anyway, he approached me one day and said, I'm leaving to take another job. Would you be interested? Well, who wouldn't be interested in the job when there's an opportunity there? So I took that and was on it. I'm not sure how many months. I think it was less than a year. It may have just been about 6 months when I heard about the sports editor at the North Penn Reporter in Lansdale leaving. The North Penn Reporter was a 5-day-a-week paper, which was, in effect, the unofficial spokesman or the unofficial paper of the leagues in our area, the high school leagues, the semi-professional leagues. So it sounded like a very good opportunity, and I took that. And then about 4 months later, had a wire from the Sporting News. We'd like to have you report on such and such a date. That's how I began.
How did they discover you? Were you scouted by somebody?
No, there's another story. In 1940, the Sporting News came out with its first baseball register. To publicize it, they carried the complete record of Frank McCormick. Buck McCormick, who had been the NL MVP in 39. And I looked at it, and right away I saw an error, and I looked more closely, and I think I found 3 errors.
Do you remember what the errors were?
No, I don't. I might be able to. I'm sure I could find them if I compared that ad with what appeared in the Sporting News. So I wrote Old Man Spink, J.G. Taylor Spink, because I assumed the book had not yet been printed. Immediately he wrote me back, how would I like to check the proofs for the entire book? I responded by mail. Telephone calls were very expensive, relatively, at that point. Wrote them back, I would. I guess the post office took a little too long to deliver the letter. I got another one back from him that too late now.
Yeah.
About a week or so later, I get a package that would have killed a horse if he had tried to chew it. And it's the proof of the whole register. And he wanted them back in, I think it was less than a week's time. Well, I found a number of mistakes, and boy, I got paid, I think it was 20 or 25 bucks for that. Man, I found the Garden of Eden there, sent them back. So that was a start. Then the next year I checked them again.
Can I just ask, what did you use to check? What references were available then?
I think, I'm not sure what I used that first year. The second, I may have bought a Who's Who in baseball, which still comes out. It's something like the Baseball Register, except it's a much smaller book. I may have used that. I know the next, and also Ready Reckoner. There were no computers, as you know, in those days. I had a Ready Reckoner. So I found a number of errors, but anyway, the indications were that he was very happy with the results for that short period of time. Then again, the next year he sent them, I had 4 weeks, I think, that I was able to work on them because I was out of work recovering from the broken hand. And I had been in contact with him for several years. On occasions, I sent a few little items about players from our area who had been in professional baseball, went into service, or the semi-pro league championship, which included a lot of former minor leaguers. And somehow, I guess he sort of followed my progress. And I think he had a fellow, there was a fellow with a Philadelphia Record named Don Bassenfelder, who used to write for the Sporting News. I think he had him doing some checking on me, although I can't be certain of that.
So you went to the Sporting News in April of 1943.
Correct.
At age 21.
Yes, yes.
And what was your first job there? And I did want to also ask you if you met J.G. Taylor Spink.
I had not met him until that point.
Okay.
I took the train out of Philadelphia on a Friday evening, rode the coach, got to St. Louis. Saturday afternoon, called him from the train station, as he suggested. He told me to take a cab, go to a certain hotel, I forget the name of it, check in, and then come to the Sporting News, which is about 3 blocks away. Now it must be 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. I get there, meet him for the first time. He was a short man, large stomach, bags under his eyes that you have not seen anywhere else. Obviously a man in charge, introduces me to two or three people. They had people working there on Saturday. Of course, they went to press Tuesday morning. The number one man in the editorial department was there. No, the editor was there. The editor was there, the proofreaders and the printers. We get back in the office and he says, the editor says you're too young. You ignore him, I'm the boss here. And before I left, he gave me a whole sheaf of proofs to read Saturday night, bring them in Sunday morning, finish them up Sunday morning. My eyes were falling out of my head that night, of course, from the train ride and everything. Put them in Sunday morning, finish them, gave them to him. He gave me a buck and a quarter, and I can go to the ballpark and see the exhibition game. And from that point on, it was 6 days a week.
Wow. What kind of office was the Sporting News in then? And also, did they call themselves the Bible of baseball?
Definitely the Bible of baseball, yes.
Okay.
In fact, only about 2 years before, one of the prominent magazines, which is now defunct, and I forget which one it was, had a big, big story on Spink as Mr. Baseball, which the commissioner, Judge Landis, did not appreciate in the least. Well, anyway, the offices at that time were at 10th and Olive, right in the corner. A drugstore downstairs. We were on the fourth floor. After being there a couple of years, you'd see some of the floorboards ripped up, and I said to somebody, by golly, we on the fourth floor of the Sporting News must have been built first, and then the other floors under it to raise us up because it was just full of dirt in there. But anyway, the offices were nothing to speak of. The editorial people were scattered in three separate spots. The number one man was right next to Spink's office in the composing room. Then came a small office, which was no more than 10 by 20, I guess. That had the editor, a columnist. I was put in there, and then there was a young fellow who helped on various chores, sort of an errand boy. Then the linotypes were the other side of us, and then there was additional editorial employees back in the, so we were all scattered. But there were only one, two, three, four, about five or six on the Sporting News editorial staff in 1943.
And did they have meetings of, like, editorial meetings to plan the issues?
Never. Never. Spink decided everything. He ran everything.
Those little headlines in the Sporting News that were sort of catchy, you know, that
they were written by a fellow named Carl Felker, whose son, Clay Felker, ran, I believe it was the New Yorker and a couple other magazines 10, 15, 30 years ago. He was about as clever a headline writer as I've ever seen. He did a great job.
Okay, let's see. Had you seen a major league game before you went to St. Louis?
I had been to two major league games, the first one when I was in about sixth grade, a group of our class, I guess the whole class or several classes, went to Philadelphia, which was 40 miles away, a long drive back in the early 30s, and I can remember sitting up in right in the stands, in the second deck in right field at Shibe Park, and wondering what all those little ants were running around on the field. I really knew almost nothing about baseball at the time. And then in 38, in the spring of 38, our high school team won its third or fourth consecutive league championship. We went down to Philadelphia to see the Phillies and Cardinals play an afternoon game. And that very evening, when we returned to Cooperstown, or maybe it was the next evening, it might have been the next evening, we had a banquet in the fire hall, and the fellow who was managing the Phillies at the time, I believe it was Hannes Lober, was the speaker. And he apparently had not known that we were down at the game. He said, gee, if I'd known, we'd had you down in the dugout.
Yeah.
So I remember distinctly seeing that game because I never saw anybody with arms like Johnny Mize, even though we're sitting out along the left field line. You could see Johnny Mize's arms just bulged. So they were the only two games I had seen prior to going to St. Louis, major league games, I did.
And then in St. Louis, what month was it when you arrived there?
Arrived the last weekend of spring training, yes.
Okay.
And I'm not sure exactly what I did that first summer, although I believe I did do some of the writing, because that was the only year that baseball had a Class E league, the Twin Ports League. And somehow it sticks in my mind that I wrote some of that and maybe some of the other minor league notes in the Sporting News.
Got to start at the bottom of the alphabet. Huh?
Right. But starting in 44, I know that my regular job was covering the triple A's. I believe they were double A's at the time, but what we know from that period is the triple A's and the double A's. That would be the American Association International, Pacific Coast, Southern and Texas. I did them.
Did you travel?
No. Nobody.
St. Louis.
Nobody in the office traveled. Okay. Not a person. We received newspapers from every city in Major League Baseball, several of them from every city. One from every city in AAA and AA, and then in the lower leagues, probably four or five or six papers from every league. And that's how the Sporting News covered these things.
Okay. So you sifted through all the papers that
right.
came in.
Right.
And then did you write features or if you ran, like, let's say you found a great feature on some player, would you ask that newspaper's permission to reprint it then?
Generally, we had a correspondent. We, the Sporting News, had a correspondent in every major, certainly in every major league city. A fellow who traveled with the team. In the triple A's, we usually would have one in almost every city, same way in the double A's. When you get down to the lower leagues, the fewer correspondents. But if you saw something that was worth a feature, we'd normally contact the regular baseball writer in that city and have them do it.
Now, your first summer in St. Louis, the Cardinals won the pennant.
Correct.
Did you get to go to many games or get to the series?
I got to quite a few games. Let's see, I believe it was 44 when Knight Baseball, 43 I believe they had a few games in St. Louis, 44 they began to, the majors, because of the war with FDR's approval, expanded the Knight schedule. I got to quite a few games. I was at the two World Series games in St. Louis in 43. Then 44, as you'll recall, the Cardinals and Browns won the pennant. And I went to every game. Something that is worth mentioning, I think, the Browns won on the last day of the season, a home game against Detroit. Excuse me, it was against the New York Yankees. We were asked to come into work on Sunday, the whole staff. About 11:30, maybe 12 o'clock, there was mention, hey, we're going out to the park. I had been totally unaware that we were going to the game. So we piled into cabs and went out to the park. The head proofreader, who was a real baseball expert, a fellow named Paul Rickard, and I traveled together. I can remember we got to Dodier Street, which was along the first baseline. You could hardly walk through. It was man to man to man. The press gate was around the corner on Spring Avenue. We went in there. We went up behind the first deck, the walkway behind the first deck along third base. And it's standing room only. There must have been 4 or 5, 6 feet. Paul Rickard and I went out to the very left field corner, stood on the railing. He on one side of a girder, I on the other, and we watched the whole game from there. And Chet Ladd's home runs we could see go up in the air, and they were lost because of the overhang, and then we'd see them come down. That was the biggest crowd, I believe, that the Browns had ever drawn, well over capacity.
That was their only pennant?
That was their only pennant. And after 43 and 44, seeing the World Series, I thought, boy, this is a great thing. Let's do it every year.
A nice perk of the job, huh? I wanted to ask you about that World Series. I was hoping you got to the games because there were a lot of interesting players. And one thing I'd like to do is just ask what you remember about some of the players. Tell you what, I'll give you some names and you just tell me what you associate with them. And if they remind you of players that I don't have on my list, feel free to ramble. Okay, let's see. The Cardinals that year, they had Harry Burkine.
Correct.
The Cat.
Correct.
Did he deserve the nickname?
Oh, yes, he was as quick as a cat on bunts, on balls hit back near the box. He had a focus like a cat, too. Boy, he could almost steer you to death, it seemed, from the stands. But he was, again, quick as a cat.
And, of course, Harvey Haddix was nicknamed the Kitten.
Correct.
Did he resemble? I mean, did they actually? You saw them both play, right?
Yes, Haddix came a little bit later.
Oh, yeah.
They did, to the extent that they were both left-handed, threw much the same. Haddix might have been a little heavier, etc. But I think just the fact that he succeeded Burkine, led to the nickname.
Yeah. He had the reputation of a good fielder, too.
Right, right.
Oh, he's got the gold glove.
Right.
Okay, but let's see. Was Burkine their ace that year, or was it Mort Cooper?
Mort Cooper was the ace, okay. Yeah. Burkine, I believe, was the number one left-hander, yes. Okay.
What do you remember about Mark Cooper?
Walker
Cooper.
His brother. Mark Cooper was a big, fairly heavy-set fellow who had a great fastball. As far as curve and so forth, I'm not sure, but obviously he must have had a lot of stuff because he had a great season. And his brother, both of them were country boys. Walker apparently didn't get along too well with the writers and was very outspoken. Mort got along pretty well with the writers. And as was the case with some players, I think both developed a drinking problem later on. But Mort Cooper was definitely one of the great pitchers of that period. And Walker was a good man behind the plate, handled the ball well, good defensively, and a good hitter, a line drive hitter.
Speaking of drinking now, did you ever run into the players in the pubs in St. Louis?
I never went in the pubs in St. Louis.
Okay. I thought that you'd be on assignment, you know, for a story.
No, again, I really covered nothing outside of the office except the winter meetings later on. About 1946, 46 or 47, Lee Allen, whose name is very familiar to baseball mm-hmm. researchers. Lee Allen joined the Sporting News. He had worked in Cincinnati as an employee, publicity man with the Reds for some years. Lee had a drinking problem too, of course, was an alcoholic. He joined us during the season of, I believe it was 46, handled what was then the Class A leagues, Eastern Sally and the Western. Somehow I thought there was a fourth one, but I guess it was just those three. He stayed there, and then that following winter, he had nothing really to do. I suggested to him that one job that might keep him busy and therefore enable him to remain on the staff was to take the blue books and make cards on all the officials listed in the blue book. Put down their name, and then each subsequent year where they were, general manager, president, vice president, traveling secretary, etc. So Lee did that pretty much that winter. The next spring he began his usual chores of covering the Class A leagues, and at one point he just sort of disappeared. He left. He, I think, had fallen off the wagon and just left. And I forget how we got started on this subject. I think, I know. Yes, Lee Allen, because of his background with the Cincinnati Reds, knew a lot of the players with Cincinnati. So on several occasions, he invited me to go along. We'd go to one of the hotels where the Cincinnati Reds stayed when they were in St. Louis. And I got to meet the Ray Muir and Newell Blackwell and the players who were with Cincinnati at that period. That's about my only contact with players during the first 20 years of the Sporting News.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the 1944 series. Mentioned Morton, Walker Cooper. Was that the Walker Cooper? Did he play for the Giants?
Correct.
Okay.
Played in the Giants later on.
Johnny Hopp.
Johnny Hopp was a good fielder, a center fielder, played first base adequately, hit fairly well, but just wasn't one of the great players. He did fill in pretty well, had a couple of fairly good seasons.
How about Whitey Kurowski?
Whitey Kurowski, I got to know a little bit. He's one, there's an exception. I got to know him because, again, Whitey had a hand deformity, not like mine, a little bit different, and also the fact that he comes from, I believe it's Slatington, Pennsylvania, near Reading. So we had a little Pennsylvania Dutch connection there, and I met him a couple times and chatted with him and have seen him once or twice in the last 30 years, I guess.
Yeah. I'm trying to recall. I read somewhere a good story about him. Might have been Old Time Baseball News. Do you see that?
No, I do not.
Out of Petoskey, Michigan?
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Huh.
Don't see that.
You'd love that. It's all Old Time Baseball News.
I can't quite keep up with what I'm getting.
I know. It's a great publication. I read it a few years ago.
Oh, good.
It comes out of Petoskey, Michigan. Who does that? D. Scott McKinstry, the McKinstry brothers.
Michigan. I wanted to check into it.
A lot of biographies of old players, and mm-hmm. not necessarily the famous players.
Right,
okay.
Right.
I think that's why I read all about Whitey. Okay, Marty Merriam, Slats. How thin was he?
Marty was, well, he was one of the thinner ball players. Of course, fairly strong muscularly, and with tendons and so forth. He was just rather phenomenal around that period. Hit pretty well, was good on the hit and run. As a fielder, he was one of the great ones until his back began bothering him. And again, he was fairly thin for a shortstop.
Was he tall?
He was about 6'2", I believe, I would guess.
And then pretty tall shortstop then. Yeah.
6 foot, 6'2", yeah. But again, he was much more slightly built than any of the players on the team. Hmm.
And Blix Donnelly was the pitcher?
Blix Donnelly. I remember the name real well. I don't remember anything specific about him. He was primarily a relief pitcher.
Okay. How about any of the other players on the Cardinals there? That was before Musial, right?
Oh, no. Musial was already up. Let's see. I'm trying to think of when he was in service, though.
Okay, maybe that's why he wasn't.
Yeah, and well, Slaughter was, no, 46 was Slaughter. Yeah, that was after the war. I believe Musial was in service for that. He was there in 43, I believe, but I believe he missed 44. Like Casey says, we can look it up.
Yes. Yep. Okay, how about some of the bronze? You know, in looking at that roster, there's not a lot of great names that stick out.
No, they're not. It was a...
Bern Stevens is one, you know, that comes
right
to me as for him, and Denny Galehouse, Don Gutteridge and Gene Moore, but, you know...
Sig Jakuki. You didn't put him down?
I didn't, no.
Sig Jakuki was one of their ace pitchers. He was...
How do you spell that last name?
J-A-K-U-C-K-I, I believe.
That's why I didn't put it down.
He was, sort of a nomad. They signed him, I believe, as a free agent. He, I believe, had been in the Coast Guard or in some shipping job, had all kinds of odd jobs. I believe it was from someplace down in the South, Texas or Louisiana. Had a good record down there, and I believe he had pitched minor league ball before. But anyway, they signed him, and he was one of their aces, along with Galehouse. Let's see, who else? Well,
Jack Kramer?
Jack Kramer, yeah. Jack Kramer was a young guy then who had a great record. But Jakuki was one of... he was the kind of guy who probably wouldn't fit too well on a college team. He was a hard drinker and hard worker and everything. Okay.
How about Mark Chrisman, the third baseman?
Mark Chrisman was a real fine guy, very adequate third baseman, good hitter. Not one of your great stars, obviously, but during wartime ball, he was among the better players during wartime situations.
Yeah, but I think that maybe that was a factor here. Maybe some of their better players were, you know, in the service.
They didn't lose any real good players. They held on to most of their players.
Yeah.
I don't remember any real star that they lost to service.
Okay.
That was one of the things which benefited them, they were able to hold on to most of theirs.
Yeah. How about Don Gutteridge, second base?
Don Gutteridge... covered a lot of ground. He was a real hustler. I believe he's the first guy I saw score on a sacrifice fly from second base. He was a leader. He was a brainy ball player and, of course, became a manager later on.
Gene Moore?
Gene Moore, remember, played right field. He was able to play the wall. The wall was fairly short. He was good there. He had a good batting average. Can't remember too much more about him.
And this is Bern Stevens. Now, this is before he went to the Red Sox.
Correct.
So was he pretty young then?
Yes, he was. He was quite young. But he and Marty Marion were almost on a par as far as being among the top shortstops of the time. Again, Bern was quite young, but he had a real strong bat even at that point. Covered shortstop quite adequately. So, as I say, he and Marion were rated being pretty much on a par.
Anybody else on the Browns?
Well, they had Jordan McQuinn, their catchers, Hayworth and Mancuso, I believe.
What kind of a team, I mean, what kind of, like, image did the team have? Did they, as history portrays them, you know, it was the only Browns team that won the pennant, and usually they go along to say it was because of the war.
They got along on a shoestring pretty much because they were second rate in St. Louis to the Cardinals. The DeWitts were in charge. They bought the team later on. The fellow who owned them was considered fairly rich at the time but didn't put a lot of money into the team. So the DeWitts had to operate pretty much on a shoestring there. And. Did a good job considering everything.
But did they, in the media of the day, did they try and have the underdog image with the Cardinals or the?
I don't think that
like the Dodgers when they played the Yankees for so many years. You know, this was the I don't know what the,
I don't recall if the newspapers in St. Louis played him up. The newspapers in St. Louis, in my judgment, were and, well, they only have one left, but were totally different than the New York papers, where they're battling one another, the newspapers, to see which can sell the most papers, and of course then take angles of the type that you're talking about. And in St. Louis, Cardinals, again, were pretty much the favorites all along, but the Browns received fairly good coverage. Now, of course, my view is maybe colored a little bit, too, by the fact that I worked at the Sporting News, and despite the fact that the Browns were the poorer of the teams and eventually left, Spink just didn't seem to care too much about the Browns, and because the people with the Browns didn't kowtow to Spink.
Mm. I got a couple questions I'm trying to phrase all at once here. I was in St. Louis. I spent a couple summers there in the 70s. So I know that where the new Bush Stadium is.
Right.
Now, where did these two teams play?
They played on Grand Avenue, which would have been about Grand Avenue and Dodier Street, which was in the northern section of the city.
Across the river.
No, not across the river.
No,
all of St. Louis is on the west side of the Mississippi.
Right, there's a difference.
Right,
east St. Louis.
Right. Bush Stadium is directly downtown, right near the river.
Okay.
And no, they played out, well, not too far from Bowman High School, where Earl Weaver and a whole bunch of future major leaguers went to school, and not too far from where the Cardinals' original ballpark was, the 1890s ballpark. But again, it was in the northern part of the city.
Okay, did they play at the same park?
They played at the same park, right. It was owned by the Browns, I believe. And then when Bush bought the Cardinals in 52, was it? 53, then they bought the car. Bush also bought the ballpark.
So was this the only World Series ever played in one park?
Oh, no. In the 20s, the Yankees played at the Polo Grounds and played the Giants there.
Okay.
21 and 22, I believe, before the
state. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Huh. Well, I was only once in a city where there was a pennant race going on. That was Pittsburgh in 1960. I left Pittsburgh after 1964, so all during the 70s, and I had to follow my team from a distance. But I know it's always exciting being in a city when there's a pennant race on, and I can't imagine what it was like with two pennant races going on in 1944 and the chance of the whole World Series being in your city. Can you say something about that? What did the city do things?
No, things were totally different back at that time. There was none of the big hoopla that you now find in some of the smaller cities like Pittsburgh. New York City is totally different, Chicago is totally different than Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Cincinnati. No, very little was done. I don't remember that they had much in the way of press parties either at that point. Of course, I was young and new to the field in 43 and 44 and even 46. And tickets were available for the games fairly readily back at that period. And of course, the prices at that time seemed to be fairly high, but they were probably $6 for the World Series.
Yeah. Did they have a parade after the team?
Don't recall if there was anything of that kind. I don't think there were any big celebrations. Number one, you have to remember that most of these clubs, the Cardinals, for example, were owned by Sam Braden, who had Branch Rickey with him until about 42. And from that point on, it was Braden, his nephew, I believe, Bill Walsingham, and two or three others. And that was the front office. And the Browns had the DeWitts and then a couple secretaries and a couple young guys working around there. And that was what ran baseball at that time.
It did.
And some of the other clubs, even the Yankees, I'm sure, were staffed by only a small handful of people.
I wonder if Peter Angelos knows what's what he's standing on there in terms of history. That's amazing when you think of Gee's Camden Yards and the way they promote a team today.
If you look at the directories today, you'll find at least 50 names mentioned for every club. This includes, of course, sometimes includes the secretaries. Mm-hmm. But back in that day, of course, that when I mentioned six people, that didn't include the scouts. They did have some scouts. But people work in the front office. Ticket, somebody in charge of tickets, and he probably did other jobs. Traveling secretary, usually had a traveling secretary. Clubs didn't have, not all clubs had PRs at that time. So it was a very economical type of operation. And of course, they didn't draw anywhere near what they do today, so the revenue was not there.
And St. Louis was really on the western edge. I mean, that
correct.
Was, that was
correct.
A long train ride away from
correct. Right.
The rest of baseball.
That's right.
You sort of wonder, how did the Bible of baseball wind up on the western edge? Actually, it was in the center of America.
Yeah, and yeah. Well, I can't give you the full history of the Sphinx, but one of the Sphinx decided to start a newspaper in St. Louis. I believe they had been connected with a newspaper in St. Louis, decided to start a sports publication, and I believe Sporting Life in Philadelphia had started 3 years earlier. So the Sphinx started in 1886. They carried cycling, running, all kinds of sports. Horse, I think there was some horse racing in there and so forth. And eventually, baseball, they focused on baseball. Baseball's popularity began to increase, too, around that period.
Do you happen to know what year they started, including box scores?
I think in 86, I think the very first year, I think they had major league box scores. Yes, I'm not sure.
Let me ask you about a couple of things that you did with the Sporting News. You were the compiler and editor of the official baseball guide and the dope book?
Yes, let's see. Not too long ago, I started to put some things down. First of all, somebody else had asked me about some of it, so... In, I think it was 1948 issue, which would have been the end of 47, that we began working on it. Now, let's see, in the 1947 guide, I was already listed as one of the compilers. 48, I believe it was the 48 guide, Edgar Brands, the editor, was told by Spink to write a review of the year in baseball. That would include the pennant winners, legislation, unusual developments. And after he finished it, Spink gave it to me. Read this thing. See, it's all right. So I went back to him and told him there were a few things I thought should be included. Fix it up. And I believe my name was put on it then. Even though Brands wrote it. And then from that point on, I wrote the review every year, began adding things such as the review of the pennant races, and a lot of the features that I saw in the old guides, which had been missing for years and years, grand slam home runs, pinch home runs, one to nothing games, no box scores of no-hitters, accounts of the no-hitters, mm-hmm. a lot of those small features. Plus, it turned out that the minor league averages, they always wanted to start a new league on the top of a page, so they'd wind up with holes at the bottom of the averages. I began writing what we called fillers. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still tell me that that's one of the best features of the guide. The guide no longer do that. In fact, after I left, they began running the things together and then eventually dropped them. But that was a place to cover a lot of the things. For example, the Georgia-Florida League, I believe it was, had one of the first black youngsters. He was a bat boy, and they put him in the game way back when. I believe Jackie Robinson was already playing, but it was unusual for a team down in the South to mm-hmm. have a black guy, and this was a black bat boy. But many of the unusual things were used in there as fillers. Anyway, I wrote about 95% of all the written matter that's in the guide from well, essentially 49 guide through 67 guide. And the dope book, I was given that assignment sometime after 48, I believe, and had to come up with ideas. He wanted something different each year. One for the book was compiled by Leonard Gettleson, but I was sort of the intermediary there and made some of the decisions, especially when the Browns were transferred to Baltimore and the Braves from Boston to Milwaukee, how we would handle that. The rule book, I eventually, I don't know how far back, I was had charge of that to the extent that when the corrections came in from the commissioner's office or the rules committee, they were given to me to see that they were set, and I had to proof them and make sure everything was right. I would make notes from time to time of things that seemed incorrect in the rules, and there still are a lot of them which they, for some reason, have declined to change. We won't get into that. Let's see, we also had a daguerreotype, Naughty Problems by Billy Evans. I used to handle that, and eventually I suggested that we should redo it because the book was getting spider webs, cobwebs on it. It was getting that old, and I sort of was in charge of when we rewrote that completely. I did some of it and had help from others.
Now, as I recall, when you subscribed to the Sporting News, some of these books came with your subscription.
Correct.
And others were just sold through the Sporting News.
Correct. The Sporting News did its own distributing. Spink, I guess, didn't want to pay a big distributing company.
You couldn't go to the bookstore and buy these books, though.
You couldn't?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. No. Now, incidentally, there are only a few of us left, I guess, but I bought a lifetime subscription in 1941, a year and a half before I went to work for the Sporting News.
You didn't get it free because you worked there?
Yeah, but I went there for maybe you'd like to take over my lifetime subscription, $25.
I changed my name. But they don't have box scores anymore.
They don't have box scores. They don't have nearly the baseball they did. However, the bottom line is presumably much better than it was. Their circulation is way above what it was when I left there in 67. But again, at that point in 67, I believe they had just in the last couple of years begun to have an outside organization handle distribution. I'm sure you're aware there are regular distributing companies, and unless you work through them, you can't get on the newsstand, etc. But then by the same token, you have to eat. You, the publisher, have to eat all the returns.
Okay. I just wanted the baseball guide again. What was the purpose of that? Just describe it a little bit.
Well, first of all, the baseball guide goes way back, as you know, to the 1860s, I believe. There were the Beetle guide, the Witt guide. And then from about, again, we can look it up, sometime in the 1880s or late 1870s, Spalding, right. Albert Goodwill Spalding, right. was in the sporting goods business later on, began to put out a guide. And Reach, A.J. Reach, who was a prominent player and got into the sporting goods business, also put out a guide. And by early 1900s, the Reach guide was theoretically the American League's official guide, although it covered the National League also. And Spalding guide was the National League's guide, even though it covered the American League. And in the early 1920s, I believe it was, Spalding began to put out the Spalding Record in addition to the Spalding Guide. And the Record would carry all of the minor league averages, whereas the Spalding Guide did not carry the minor league averages.
So there was the Reach minors and majors?
Reach was minors and majors.
Okay.
And they continued up to 39, I believe, when they merged, 39 or 40. For 2 years there was a Spalding Reach Guide. And then they went out of business. Spink stepped into the void, put out his first guide in 42 because of the story calling him in one of the big magazines calling him Mr. Baseball. Judge Landis got teed off at him and wouldn't give him official sanction for the 43 guide, I believe it was. The 43 and 44 guides of the Sporting News were not very good. Because Spink cut corners, he didn't run all the averages in the minor leagues, and At the same time, Landis decided to put out his own guide, so he put out two of them. One of them came well over a year late, but he put out two of them, so there are two Landis guides. And then somehow after Landis died, of course, Happy Chandler came in. Spink was a big, big booster of Happy Chandler. Spink was a big booster of Happy Chandler and vice versa, and I got the support of Major League Baseball. And incidentally, it might be worth noting that the box scores of the minor leagues that were run by the Sporting News were actually, in effect, paid advertisements. Very few people know it, but the leagues paid some money for the Sporting News to carry them. Now, when that began, I don't know, but I was directly involved one year where I had to plead with one of the minor league presidents to come through with his money or else he would not get his box scores in there.
Well, the box scores, I guess, were prestigious that they appeared in the Sporting News.
Right. And there were some, for example, the Texas League president was J. Alvin Gardner, who I presume, from what I know, was a fairly wealthy man, and of course, he wanted to see that his league was in there, and that was Double A, whereas some of the others, they had three higher leagues. There were two Double A's, three Triple A's, and of course he came through readily with the money, so the others didn't want to be shown up by the Texas League. And so there was really, so far as I'm aware, very little difficulty in getting them to pay until later years when things became a little tough in the minor leagues.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. I know they probably suffered a lot during the war.
The Sporting News?
No, the minor leagues.
I mean, oh yes, they went down to about eight, I think it was.
Wow.
A year or two, yes. And at that point, Spink came up with the idea, well, he had connections in the military, came up with the idea of putting out a service edition and got somebody to sponsor it. I don't know if it was the military or whether it was like Chesterfield Cigarettes, who sponsored it, but he got heavy sponsorship and put out an eight-page edition every week of the Sporting News for people over, service people overseas. As soon as the regular edition was just about off the press, and I handled this a couple times, I don't know why he put me in charge a couple times, but you'd go to the press room and decide which articles and which features. Spink told you pretty well which features to put in, but then you had to arrange to cut the material and be sure it all fit the space that was allocated.
And did you actually have to work with the typesetting?
Yes, yes. Well, the type's already set at that point.
Yeah.
But work with the printer as he moved it around and cut where it was necessary and make some minor editorial adjustments.
Okay, and what was the dope book?
The dope book carried the rosters, the directories. This normally would come out about the start of the season. We ran a little late because only one or two of us are handling all of these books, and Spink didn't seem to be disturbed by the fact that they came out a little later than would seem normally to be appropriate. Carried the rosters of the teams, diagrams of the ballparks. I think I suggested that after we had carried some of the Sporting News.
So it was like a little profile of teams then?
Each team would have four pages, as I recall. One would be the directory with information about the uniforms on it and something else to fill out the space, I think the radio and broadcasters. Another page would be a diagram of the ballpark. Another would be year-by-year standings with the manager. And the fourth one escapes me right at the moment. But, the roster, yes, the roster. So there were two pages of type and two pages essentially. No, three. Well, anyway,
okay.
Those were the four. And then also I had to have a bunch of features in there too. One year it was the guys who hit four home runs in a game, a page or two with description of what happened in the box score. Another year it was no-hitters, as I recall. Various outstanding records in baseball were amplified. And played up in these little features. Are these guys available now in the Hall of Fame library?
I presume. I'm not sure.
I think they are too. I'm not.
They're available in my library, but that.
And what's going to happen to your library?
That's not decided at the moment.
I'm familiar a little bit with what's in the Hall of Fame library. I've had a tour or two there, and I know somebody does research there, or is a research assistant.
Well, it's changed around totally since I was there, so I'm not sure exactly what they have. I didn't have occasion, really, to, as I recall, to refer to the dope book any time, so when I was there, so I'm not sure that they have a complete collection. I would assume they do.
Yeah. Does the Sporting News itself have a good collection of its past publications?
And I can't answer that. I've been there a number of times. I haven't looked. I think they do. Yes, yeah. I'm rather sure they do. We had, when I was there, we had almost nothing in the way of resource material. In fact, I don't think they had a morgue until very shortly after I came. A few months after I started, he brought in a fellow named Oscar Ruhl, R-U-H-L, who was about 15 years older than I. He became, in effect, the editor and one of my biggest boosters. He, as I recall, said that he was the one who got him to start a morgue. In other words, a clipping file, clipping everything out of the Sporting News and filing it for future reference, clipping feature stuff out of newspapers that came in, filing it for feature purposes. In fact, I don't believe they even had a photo file. Normally, once a week, one of the printers was sent down to the Post-Dispatch or the Globe Democrat to borrow a picture or two to run on the paper.
Wow.
But from that point on, we began building up a morgue there. And sometime after I departed the Sporting News, I guess a number of years, they really had one person in charge as an archivist. Paul McFarlane did that for a while, and now they have Steve Getcher, who I presume spends most of his time in that department, although he does a little writing too.
Steve is one of the names that comes up frequently in the Saber Elk
publication. Right, right, right.
And he seems to be, you know, very anxious to help people with research using the Sporting News resources.
Right.
So, the name I see quite a bit now.
Let me throw something in here while I think of it. That brings it. One of the first jobs I can remember doing at the Sporting News, and I think it was the first winter I was there. Now again, the first summer, I believe I did cover some of the minor leagues. Season's over, what do I do? Spink had made an arrangement with Albert Mitchell, the answer man. You're too young to remember that, but there was a famous
radio
program called Albert Mitchell, the answer man. I believe it was on once a week. Anybody, everybody was invited to send in questions they had. Some of them were baseball questions. Spink made some arrangement with him. Have him send the baseball questions in. That first winter, I had drawers full of questions. The dates would be cut off in many cases because Albert Mitchell might have had them around for a while or whatever purpose. But one of my first jobs was answering those. I had to fix up an answer, give them to Spink. After he sees them 2 or 3 days, as I recall, you'd answer them directly. And so I did that directly. I think that was only that one winter, and it's quite possible that the arrangement terminated after that. I'm not familiar with the details. And then a year or two later, and this is sort of a sideline too, a year or two later, during that period, Spink was having one of the staff members, usually his right-hand man, take one of the features and retype it, change a few things, and Spink says, putting Spink's name in there. And this was sent out to the radio people. Spink hoping, of course, that they would run this and he'd get all the credit. Incidentally, he didn't write anything for the Sporting News. Those columns that, under his name, Looping the Loops and forget the name of the other column, and other features with his name on were written by other people. He'd like them so much, or he'd arrange with the writer to use his name. But anyway, one time he had me do that radio column, and into the office comes a young guy, a little older than I, who was hoping to become a radio man and did broadcast on some small station at St. Louis University. He didn't want that kind of stuff. He wanted something original.
He was a runner for Dizzy Dean, who was broadcasting baseball. Well, let's see, Dizzy, this was a little later. I think Dizzy was already doing some broadcasting. Anyway, so I worked for this guy for, I don't know how many months or a year, I guess it was, a little freelance on the side. He wanted one of the little country-ish like Dizzy Dean was, and of course, baseball authenticity in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you missed Dizzy Dean as a player. He was gone by 44, but was he still in the St. Louis area? You know, he must have been a local hero then.
Well, let's see, what World Series was it, 45 that he pitched for? What year was it he pitched? I can't remember. No, he was finished pitching, that's right.
Yeah,
he was finished pitching.
He had like come back. 10 or 11 year.
Yeah.
He came
back to the broadcaster, that's right. Yes, he was back there around 43, 44. They had...
Now, he unretired and pitched in a game.
They had him right, pitched for the Browns. Right, pitched for the Browns in one game as a...
Do you remember that?
...promotional gimmick. Yes, I was there, as I recall.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to recall.
I think it was the last day of the season.
Yeah, he had been complaining. The story I read, I guess, was that he had been complaining about the pitching.
Oh, yeah.
Said he could do a better job.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
So they gave him a chance to prove it, and he was pitching well, as I recall.
He pitched about three innings, was it?
Something like that. And then he hit a double and pulled a muscle running it out.
Yeah,
and had to come out of the game.
Right, right, right. But again, it was one of the few promotional gimmicks of the time.
Yeah.
he was quite popular, and of course contentious too, because of the things he said.
Let's see, you were speaking of gimmicks though, you were there when Eddie Gaedel was
I was there when Pete Gray was there too.
Okay, yeah.
Pete Gray was 1944.
Now, did he play in that series?
45. He came up the next year.
Okay.
He came up
I didn't see his name in the 44 series.
No, he was at Memphis in 44, came up in 45. I saw him come within 3 feet of a home run on, I believe it was July the 4th. I was sitting out, it was a real hot day, so I think almost nobody there. So I sat way high in the stands out along the right field line, and he hit a ball that came within about 3 feet of going on the roof.
Did you get the ball?
No. I wasn't much of a souvenir collector at that point to begin with, but he couldn't have very well gotten that ball.
Did he hit many home runs?
None
at all?
None.
So you saw him came close?
Yeah.
Come close. Okay.
And then, you're talking about Eddie Gaedel.
Eddie, yes. Now, did you go to that game? Or did you witness
that's
that?
A sad story.
You had tickets.
That was in August of 1951, I believe.
Sounds
on a Sunday. Browns played Detroit. Both of them were pretty lousy teams. We had our first daughter, who was then about 9 months old, and some lady sitting in the front room persuaded me not to go because it wasn't too much of an attraction as a game. Of course, we knew that it was going to, the Browns were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the American League, and this was their promotion. And I guess about the only person outside of Vec, Gaedel, Bob Fischel, who knew about it was Bob Bragg of St. Louis. Sports editor. He had been tipped off by Vec the night before. And in fact, because he had been tipped off, he tipped off one of his paper's photographers to be there. Otherwise, there would have been no picture. And as a consequence, they did get that picture. But anyway, I missed that game.
So they didn't have photographers routinely at the games?
No.
Now, what I'm trying to remember, wasn't it the player that Eddie was sent in to pinch hit for was just so upset about the whole thing that he retired shortly after or quit the game?
I don't recall that part. It was the second game of a doubleheader.
Yeah.
Gaedel popped out of a cake,
paper
mache cake, I guess it was. Incidentally, I think every fan was received a piece of cake that was announced beforehand. He popped out of the cake and people thought, well, that's it. The Browns took the field. Detroit batted in the first inning. Now, the Browns come in for their last half of the first inning. Frank Sauchet, the left fielder, is supposed to be the leadoff man. And they sent Gaedel up there. And Ed Hurley, I think, was the umpire. He was all shook up and went over to see Zach Taylor. And Zach Taylor showed him a contract and everything. So they pitched to him. When he got the... Goodell was warned. Goodell took this seriously. He was going to hit that ball, and Vex, you probably have read the story where Vex said, I'm going to have somebody on the roof with a gun. You better not move that bat off your shoulder. Anyway, when he gets to first base, I believe it was Jim Delsing who replaced him as a runner. Mm-hmm. Sauchet, as I remember, finished that season with the Browns, was somewhat of a disappointment. I guess maybe that was his only season in the major league. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have to look that up. But I remember doing some research on that, and that's a tidbit that usually isn't passed along with the story about the player who got really didn't think this was, major league baseball.
I don't recall the part about Sauchet quitting baseball or anything, threatening to quit, because I'm sure he was upset, and as I recall, it was his only season, because again, he...
How about Delsing?
Delsing was a pretty good ball player.
Did he continue to play?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
that wasn't... Yeah, he was a center fielder.
Okay. Huh. Okay. So you got to be in a Bill Wreck town. Now, all the promotions didn't really save the Browns.
No.
They had too many strikes against them, really, I guess, because of the stadium arrangement.
The
Cardinals being popular.
Let's see, by that time, the Browns owned the stadium. But the Cardinals were so popular. Yeah, the Cardinals were so popular. And St. Louis is one of the smaller major league cities, as you know. So the Cardinals would draw the entertainment money away from the Browns. The Browns' history had been so bad, too, for years. Poor teams.
Let's see, you were there when they moved to Baltimore. What was the... reaction? Did anybody take them to court to try and stop them?
Not at all. Nobody seemed to care. That was one thing that sort of bothered me, that Spink seemed not at all to care about it.
That was really the first move in 50 years, wasn't it?
Well, let's see. That's right. It came a year ahead of Austin to Milwaukee.
Right.
That was the first one.
That was before I was I started following baseball in 57, so I have no recollection of that at all.
First of all, the Browns were planning to move to Los Angeles just before war broke out. In fact, I think they were planning at the winter meetings, which came about the time war broke out, a week or two later, they were planning to petition to move out there. Vec wanted to move the Browns to Milwaukee, as I recall, the year before, and was turned down. And then, of course, because he was turned down, realized he better get out of baseball and sold it to Baltimore. But he had planned to move the year before because he foresaw that the Browns weren't going to be able to make it against the Cardinals, especially with Bush moving out.
Yeah, I was just curious. I know Baltimore was always a terrific minor league city.
Right.
The long history. Now, what happened to that franchise? Did Baltimore continue to support a minor league team as well?
No. I don't recall where the franchise was moved. Havana, Cuba came in the league around that time. And the Havana franchise, I just don't recall. It's easy to look up, but I don't recall.
I could look it up too. I thought maybe it was fresh in your mind.
No.
Okay. So you're with the Sporting News 24 years. What are some of the highlights that you remember? Is that what you're doing there with that little project?
Well, there were a couple things. Some things which sort of relate to what Saberites do.
Okay.
In 1946, was it, that feller struck out 348. And the question was, did he break Rube Waddell's record? Somehow I got working on Rube Waddell's record with the help of a fella in Toledo, I think, I believe the Toledo Blade had a correspondent in Washington. I'm not sure if Joe Simonick was involved. I don't think Joe was involved at that time. But anyway, we got play-by-plays of a lot of the games that Waddell pitched to see how many strikeouts he actually had, and play-by-plays would differ on some of these things. But I had an item in the Sporting News at that time about that particular rule. And then in 1953, actually the 54 guy, but the 53 Sporting News, I changed Nat Lajoie from a 401 batting average back to 422. for the year 1901. What presumably happened there? Oh, there are two Sabre guys that should deserve a lot of credit. They're both deceased now. John Tattersall of Philadelphia and Hass. I can't think of his first name now. Alex Hass of Berkeley, California. Both had sent into the Sporting News a record, day-by-day record of Nat Lajoie's 1901 season. One came up with 229 hits, as I recall. One came up with 232, looking through box scores. Now, you have to remember, in 1901, each paper, doubtless, compiled its own box score. The guy covering the game may have covered it, or the guy in the newspaper office.
Was there an official score?
There was an official score. But the press box, they didn't have press boxes the way they had in later years, so the guys might have been separated a good bit. And sometimes one writer would score it as a hit, the other writer or the official scorer would score it as an error. And so your box scores differed, and that could affect your hits, obviously.
Was there an official score book in which the official scorer kept score?
I don't think there is today an official score book.
No.
Somebody's appointed official scorer. He fills out an official score sheet after the game
and
sends him to the league. And the league statistician looks at it, and if he sees mistakes, he writes back. And 30 years ago, I know, one of the statisticians, the American League statistician, told me how he wrote somebody, and the guy writes back, that's the way it happened. The way I sent it in is the way it is.
Yeah.
Wouldn't even make the corrections that were obviously needed. So it was by hook or crook on some of these things, guessing by golly. But anyway, with that information, I pursued it, and what presumably happened was that the official averages were issued first in Chicago, which was the American League headquarters, Van Johnson, and one of the Chicago papers had 229 hits. Somebody either they didn't have photocopy. They probably had press sheets sent out to some of the other papers, and a 9 smudged a little bit looks like a 0. Mm-hmm. And that is quite obviously what happened. For a number of years, his averages showed Lajoie 220 hits, 422 average. 220 hits comes out to 401 average. So I think it was in 1913, 405, not 401. Not the 1918 Spalding record dropped his average from 422 down to 405.
Because of the missing 9 hits.
Right, right. So that was apparently the background of that. And that's...
How are those records today in the McMillan Dictionary and Baseball America?
I think total baseball may have 232 hits plus 229. Yes. I think they
found 3 more.
You want to stop it all? Well, no.
Okay, so it does have 232.
Correct.
We looked it up. So is that 422?
That raises his average even more.
Okay, so he's a little few points higher. So that was one of the projects you did there. I was asking for other highlights while you were at the Sporting News.
I began going to the minor league winter meetings each December, starting in 1944 or 45. And the first year or two, I really just was along to see what was happening. And then I began doing some of the writing. The editor did most of it, the big features. When Edgar Brands retired, and I'm not sure what year that was, then I was, in effect, the head writer, the lead writer, for the winter meetings. Laurel Reidenbaugh went along for several years, and then Oscar Kahn and I would cover them. And I'm not sure what year it was that we went from the minor league meetings directly to the major league meetings and covered them too. But so we covered both the majors and minors for a few of them years there.
Well, tell me a little something about the minor league meetings. Who came and...
Oh, the minor league meetings were big time back in the 40s and 50s.
How many leagues would be invited and who represented?
Every league was there.
Every minor league?
Every league was there. The league presidents had votes. The big thing at way back in the late 40s and early 50s was legislative, because the majors were starting to intrude and taking over more, and then when television came, the intrusion became terrible. So the minor leagues were trying to pass rules to govern their own operations and trying to put through rules that the major leagues would accept as far as not televising into our territory, things of that kind.
Who represented the minor league teams? The owners?
Almost always the owner, yeah, because again, the minor leagues, a minor league team would be operated by had worked in Cincinnati as an employee, publicity man with the Reds for some years. Lee had a drinking problem too, of course, was an alcoholic. He joined us during the season of, I believe it was 46, handled what was then the Class A leagues, Eastern Sally and the Western. Somehow I thought there was a fourth one, but I guess it was just those three. He stayed there, and then that following winter, he had nothing really to do. I suggested to him that one job that might keep him busy and therefore enable him to remain on the staff was to take the blue books and make cards on all the officials listed in the blue book. Put down their name, and then each subsequent year where they were, general manager, president, vice president, traveling secretary, etc. So Lee did that pretty much that winter. The next spring he began his usual chores of covering the Class A leagues, and at one point he just sort of disappeared. He left. He, I think, had fallen off the wagon and just left. I forget how we got started on this subject. I know. Yes, Lee Allen, because of his background with the Cincinnati Reds, knew a lot of the players with Cincinnati. So on several occasions, he invited me to go along. We'd go to one of the hotels where the Cincinnati Reds stayed when they were in St. Louis. And I got to meet the Ray Muir and Ewell Blackwell and the players who were with Cincinnati at that period. That's about my only contact with players during the first 20 years of the sporting news.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the 1944 series. Mentioned Morton, Walker Cooper. Was that the Walker Cooper? Did he play for the Giants?
Correct.
Okay.
Traded him to the Giants later on.
Johnny Hopp.
Johnny Hopp was a good fielder, a center fielder, played first base adequately, hit fairly well, but just wasn't one of the great players. He did fill in pretty well, had a couple of fairly good seasons.
How about Whitey Kurowski?
Whitey Kurowski, I got to know a little bit. He's one, there's an exception. I got to know him because, again, Whitey had a hand deformity, not like mine, a little bit different, and also the fact that he comes from, I believe it's Slatington, Pennsylvania, near Reading. So we had a little Pennsylvania Dutch connection there, and I met him a couple times and chatted with him and have seen him once or twice in the last 30 years, I guess.
Yeah. I'm trying to recall. I read somewhere a good story about him. Might have been Old Time Baseball News. Do you see that?
No, I do not.
Out of Petoskey, Michigan?
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Huh.
Don't see that.
You'd love that. It's all Old Time Baseball News.
I can't quite keep up with what I'm getting.
I know. It's a great publication. I read it a few years ago.
Oh, good.
It comes out of Petoskey, Michigan. Who does it? He's got the McKinstry brothers.
Oh,
from Michigan.
I have to check into it.
A lot of biographies of old players, and not necessarily the famous players.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I think that's why I read all about Whitey. Okay, Marty Merriam, Slats. How thin was he?
Marty was, well, he was one of the thinner ball players. Of course, fairly strong muscularly and with tendons and so forth. He was just rather phenomenal around that period. Hit pretty well, was good on the hit and run. As a fielder, he was one of the great ones until his back began bothering him. Mm-hmm. Again, he was fairly thin for a shortstop.
Was he tall?
He was about 6'2", I believe, I would guess.
And that was pretty tall shortstop. Yeah.
6 foot, 6 foot two, yeah. Again, he was much more slightly built than any of the players on the team.
And Blix Donnelly was the pitcher?
Blix Donnelly. I remember the name real well. I don't remember anything specific about him. He was primarily a relief pitcher.
Okay. How about any of the other players on the Cardinals there? That was before Musial, right?
Oh, no. Musial was already up. Let's see. I'm trying to think of when he was in service, though.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's why he was.
Yeah. And well, Slaughter was, no, 46 was Slaughter. Yeah, that was after the war. I believe Musial was in service for that. He was there in 43, I believe, but I believe he missed 44. Like Casey says, we can look it up.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, how about some of the bronze? You know, in looking at that roster, there's not a lot of great names that stick out.
No, they're not. It was a...
Bern Stevens is one, you know, that comes
right
to me as for him, and Denny Galehouse, Don Gutteridge and Gene Moore, but, you know...
Sig Jakuki. You didn't put him down.
I didn't, no.
Sig Jakuki was one of their ace pitchers. He was...
How do you spell that last name?
J-A-K-U-C-K-I, I believe.
That's why I didn't put it down.
He was sort of a nomad. They signed him, I believe, as a free agent. He, I believe, had been in the Coast Guard or in some shipping job. Had all kinds of odd jobs. I believe it was from someplace down in the South Texas or Louisiana. Had a good record down there, and I believe he had pitched minor league ball before. But anyway, they signed him, and he was one of their aces, along with Galehouse. Let's see, who else?
Jack Kramer?
Jack Kramer, yeah. Jack Kramer was a young guy then who had a great record. But Jakuki was one of... He was the kind of guy who probably wouldn't sit too well on a college team. He was a hard drinker and hard worker and everything. Okay.
How about Mark Christman, the third baseman?
Mark Christman was a real fine guy, very adequate third baseman, good hitter. Not one of your great stars, obviously, but during wartime ball, he was a among the better players during wartime situations.
Yeah, but I think that maybe that was a factor here. Maybe some of their better players were, you know, in the service.
They didn't lose any real good players. They held on to most of their players.
Yeah.
I don't remember any real star that they lost to service. Okay. That was one of the things which benefited them, that they were able to hold on to most of theirs.
Yeah. How about Don Gutteridge, second base?
Don Gutteridge covered a lot of ground. He was a real hustler. I believe he's the first guy I saw score on a sacrifice fly from second base. He was a leader. He was a brainy ball player and, of course, became a manager later on.